Hello and welcome to Prime Lenses. I'm Ian. Each week, I speak with a guest about three lenses that have meant something to them on their photographic journey. And this week, my guest is Dan Rubin. Dan is a photographer, creative director, and designer based in the UK. His career has taken him around the world, shooting campaigns with a variety of cameras and formats. As you'll hear, I caught up with Dan ahead of Photo London to talk about how he came back around to film, how Polaroid was instrumental in showing him something magical in analog things, and why he's so excited about the Widelux revival project. It's a good chat. Here, without further ado, is Dan. Does your jumper there say photography on it?
It does.
Yes.
I figured I would be thematically appropriate.
It's good.
Today.
Excellent. It's a good podcasting jumper as well, by the sounds of it, because it doesn't also rustle. I've got my podcasting jumper on for the same reason.
Yeah, it doesn't make any noise. I mean, it's bad enough that I have to deal with, no one's forcing me to keep this beard, but this and microphones, depending on their placement.
Sure.
If I did some stuff with the folks at Camera Store back in October. Hmm. We recorded some just conversations while I was in Finland, and they use lav mics.
Yeah.
And that and a beard is really dangerous territory. I also love the fact that you just hit record, and anything that's useful in this first 15-20 minutes you just include, and it's part of the conversation.
It's funny again, it's what's nice about talking about creative practice, right? We are the things we make are a collection of inputs and influences from a bunch of other places, which will be a nice segue onto kind of talking to you about some of your work and career, I think, because I think I see something similar there. But it's things like Marin, it's things like I love listening to The Verge, I love listening to a mix of comedy podcasts and then quite formal and structured things. I listen to a show called My Perfect Console, where the host of that does a big intro with the guest on. So if he was talking to you, he'd be like, Dan Rubin, you are a creative director and artist and photographer working in London, and and that I never wanted to do that to a guest, because I was worried that would make them feel, because it's quite often his guests go, oh wow, because it's like being present at a reading of your own obituary, it's quite a lot to put someone through. So I kind of do the mix. I let myself do the Miles Davis. I hit record when you come into the parking lot, just in case, and then we go from there. But I do my little intro at a later date, so as not to kind of put people on the spot.
I like that. Yeah. There's a parallel there to certain types of portrait photography as well, I think, that I've talked with people about on and off, but it came up last week while I was at this journalism conference in Dublin, which is all about mobile journalism. So I spoke at the first one 10 years ago because I was one of the early adopters of smartphone photography. Mm. And they were trying to figure out how to teach good practices for creating what was mostly just stills imagery back then. Mm. On smartphones for journalists who were being thrown out into the field without a photographer anymore. They were having to be, two or three people on their own crew. And what I find interesting is that now that problem has kind of been solved from a technological perspective. We can film absolutely everything, yeah, motion and stills, on a small device, and everyone kind of knows how, and there's an ecosystem around that. But we still have the conversations of how the thing we're using affects the person we're speaking to or interacting with, yeah, which is a valuable conversation, but it doesn't happen a lot in photography circles for me, because, yeah, people have their favorite gear and they like their gear, and the gear is a very personal thing, and they don't really think about how the gear impacts and influences the person on the other side of it if they're doing portraiture work, whether, mm-hmm, it's wedding photography or street or just straight up portraits or even corporate headshots, right? And something that I found a long time ago, before I ever thought about doing photography in any kind of commercial capacity, was the camera that got me really into photography as a medium, the camera that I connected with, and it 100% was a combination of the camera and the film, was the folding Polaroid SX70,
yeah,
which is still my favorite thing. It's just a wonderful object, and I never thought it would be a gateway drug to, mm, taking pictures and owning far too many cameras and doing all the things I've done through photography. But one thing that I remember thinking right away was it was obvious that not only did I react to the object in a really positive way, but anyone who saw it, even if I was, I'd be flying and I'd be going through airport security, and TSA folks would be like marveling at it and want me to, they're like, oh, that's a camera? Oh, open it. And then I'd open it. And suddenly you'd have a 5-minute conversation where they were thinking how cool this thing is. And when you, what I've realized through just trial and error is that if you, you can have cameras that are intimidating to the subject. And that's the same for, like you were saying with the intro, you can, there are ways of doing everything that involves someone else. You could, there's probably a parallel to this with hairdressers, right? You know, just basically any kind of service industry interaction, there will be a parallel to this where you can overwhelm someone and you can intimidate them or not. It's not, it's not that it's a given in any circumstance. So people can be very intimidated by having a big black DSLR or mirrorless camera with a massive lens, this gaping hole of glass pointing at them. Or you take this Polaroid out and it transforms like a transformer and suddenly they're really interested. Or you have a Rolleiflex or literally anything that doesn't look like a traditional camera. Yeah. And that's something that I also found was true and still is true about these. You can take a picture of someone in a public space, you know, whether they know about it or not, or you're just doing street work, you can use this as a camera. No one looks at you. They almost don't consider it a camera, even though we all know that it is and it's quite capable. You pull out anything that looks more serious and you might have a more negative interaction. And and there's a sliding scale there. But I love that there is this parallel as well in what you're doing about just easing people into it. Not everyone is really comfortable with this. Not everyone sits in front of a mic. Not everyone, I mean, you think about how awkward people are on Zoom and Teams meetings, even when they do it every day. This is not a normal thing, and most people don't like it. So I appreciate the fact that you've given that level of attention to detail in just how you want to approach the storytelling, because I think that is what I've got a queue of your episodes to listen to, but the ones I've listened to, it's like, this is, it just feels really instantly like you're dropped into a conversation.
Yeah.
And there's something really neat about, it's like, oh, okay, these guys, these people have known each other for a long time, or it's, there's a comfort level right off the bat. And that says a lot for the approach, but also for you. But it's a tough thing. I've done a handful of interview-based projects, and I want to do more because I'm getting myself into documentary filmmaking, as well as documentary projects that aren't necessarily meant to be motion, but they're, you know, a combination of stills and written interviews.
Yeah,
capturing information. I've just been fascinated by it my entire life, and it is not an easy thing to do.
No, getting straight in, getting close to folks, and getting kind of straight into a conversation with them. Often when you're on a time limit as well, like when I spoke to Craig the other week, it was off mic afterwards, but he was like, "Thanks for keeping to time." And but in order to, because he's got a book to promote, and so he's doing a lot of calls, and it's late night for him, so it was great to actually like finally sit down, having followed his work for so long, be able to sit down and talk to someone. So it is a privilege to get access to folks, especially folks you've wanted to talk to for a while. It's a privilege to be able to do something like this. It's such a gift. Like, I always end these conversations, it's like coming off stage, because you're just like excited, because you just got to talk to someone and they were excited and hopefully they had a nice time. You know, like, and I think, so I think it's, it, like you say, archival, for archival stuff or posterity. Do you know, I'm just repeating lots of things I've said on the show before, but Austin Kleon's book about stealing like an artist. Like, the podcast is also stock, right? We're in a state of flow while we're making it, but the nice thing is it produces stock. So we've got something afterwards that isn't an asset, that is a thing that can be enjoyed by people and hopefully is as interesting to people years from now as it was on the day that we sat down and made it. So, those documentary projects sound really, really cool. If you're getting to sit down with folks and record something that is an archive or like a store of something, you know?
Well, and it's like you were saying, there are things that will only get done if those of us who are interested in doing the thing just sit down and do them. And it still blows my mind sometimes, even though I understand how it works, when if you sit back and think, oh, there are 8-something billion people on this planet, and yet there is a really high likelihood that that specific thing will never happen unless you do it.
Yeah.
Even if it happens in a different way, that's a different thing. That's an iteration. Mm-hmm. The way that you have it in your head is likely to never exist unless you are the one who does it. And I think that is one of the most fascinating and fantastic things about the human condition, is that it's really easy to assume that everything has been done before, that it's, you know, we have so many conversations in creative industries, plural, about the challenge of creating something unique and original. And a lot of people have a particular version of in their head of what that means. And I've always approached it from the opposite, like the opposite direction, I guess, as a starting point, where my assumption is it's easy to make something unique. You just have to figure out what the combination of, for me, it's almost always at least three elements. If you can combine three things, something that's interesting to you, that's personal to you, a topic you're also interested in, and then doing it in a way that you are also interested in, chances are no one else will have done, they might have thought about it, but very few people do the thing they think about. It's very unlikely that someone will have done that thing or is even doing it. And so that little doubting voice in our head that stops a lot of people from making any progress, from even taking the first step into a project or a company or whatever, writing their book, whatever the thing is, it's a lot of the time I think that the negative voice is saying, ah, well, someone else has done this, or someone else is probably working on this, or no one's going to be interested in this is another one. And like my documentary projects I'm working on, if I'm the only one interested in them, I'm completely okay with that. That's again been one of my just anchors for as long as I can remember. And I think before that, it was a thing I just did without really consciously being aware of it or having thought about it. I didn't have a framework in place for thinking about it. You just, you know, when you're younger, you just do things. You don't care if anyone else is interested in, you find a string, a thread, and you pull on it. Yeah. And like you were saying, if you, that comment about if you do something for 10 years consistently, you're going to be good at it.
Yes.
Like you're unlikely to, you know, fail is a weird word as well, because I think people are terrified of whatever the version in their head is that, you know, describes and defines failure. And I remember having a talk about this in the design world, kind of the design and web overlap. Gosh, this might have been 2009 or 10 at I can't remember what the conference was, but it was education focused, even though it was under the umbrella of the web and design. And it was somewhere in Orlando. A friend of mine was co-running it and invited me to speak. And what I decided to speak on was this concept of the fear of failure, because at the time that was a big discussion in those circles.
Right.
People not trying something because they were afraid it wasn't going to work. And my argument was, it's an experiment. Yeah. You can't fail at an experiment. You just learn something. It goes the way you think, and it confirms your biases, and you move on, or it goes some other way and you learn something and you move on. Yeah. And if we just replace that idea of failing at something with experiment, with trial and error, it frees us up. It's the exact same. Nothing in our process has changed. It's just about how we frame it. And you know, I don't know. This is also, you're experiencing right now something that is indicative of every conversation that I have ever had and probably will ever have, which is everything becomes a tangent. I can't even remember how we got into this, but we were talking about cameras. This also makes me, the tangents are going to continue. Paul Theragood, obviously a good friend of both of ours, and our link in the Moo chain, because I guess you started not that long after I wrapped up as CD.
So
I think that's what Paul said to me.
It might be the other way around. I'm not sure, but I was very early on. So I was employee like number 9 at Moo.
Oh, okay. No,
the other way around. Yeah. I came and went before you arrived, I think, which is a great pity, because I think we'd have enjoyed working together. It would have been really cool. And I left a bit too early. I timed it badly, really. But the chance came up to do something that was adjacent to open sourcey type stuff, and so I jumped. But Paul is a delightful fellow, and off doing really fun, like also creative project stuff, you know, making things and putting them out into the world and conducting experiments in a very real way.
And he's one of the things that he and I initially clicked on within days of my first day at Moo, and it's why I think we've remained really good friends since then, is that he also approaches creative work in a very open way. There's no such thing as something that's impossible to do. It's just that we haven't figured out how yet. And that's one of the conversations he and I had very early on. It's like, all right, we're going to be friends for life. And I think he'll actually, it'll be after, you know, before in the timeline, whenever this gets published, but I think he's going to be in the UK next week and we're going to try and meet up. Because I haven't seen him, I think the last time I saw him in person was a year ago when I went up to New York, New Jersey for a couple of days. Yeah. And never enough time with that man. But also anyone who Paul speaks highly of, I know I don't even have to question it. And so, I mean, he had introduced us and I was kind of like, all right, great. Let's do it. Whatever it is, let's do it.
An important question then. Segues allowed, because you've been doing a lot of film stuff in the last few years, it feels like, and I'm always fascinated to talk to film people because I'm scared is maybe the wrong word, but I'm wary of film, partly out of not being a patient person and waiting for stuff to come back, but also from it's funny, I came up through digital, so I trust the process of digital cameras just implicitly, because you very quickly get that confirmation that you got a shot, even if it wasn't the one that you wanted, which is why Moo was such a great, I loved it, I was obsessed with photography and Flickr, and then Moo comes along and is printing, is making you able to print all these lovely packs of cards and have them in your pocket the whole time before iPhones were a thing, so you've got your kind of portfolio in your pocket and the stuff we used to talk about there. So it was an obvious jumping off point for me, but I'm increasingly talking to people who love film and are very comfortable with the medium. So talk me through where your head's at right now with regards to film, maybe, and if you're using it a lot.
Well, yeah, I think at this point, when I talk about the percentage of work that I'm doing on film versus digital, it's somewhere in the 90%.
Right.
And whenever I say that, because it came up again, the workshop I was running at this journalism conference was all about lessons that we can learn and apply to digital workflows, but we can learn from analog workflows and tools, and generally to increase the quality of output and decrease the amount of post-production time. That's how I kind of frame that. But whenever I say, yeah, about 90% of my work is film, I'm always thinking it's probably a lot higher than that, unless you include every single picture that I take on an
sure.
iPhone.
Yeah.
But I started, it's weird for me. I'm a hybrid everything. I love digital, I love tech. I've been an early adopter with so many things, including the web and designing and coding for it, smartphones, not just on the photography side. My designer brain loves new things. You know, I'm doing a lot of playing around with AI in all of its forms because I'm fascinated with what it's going to become, not just what it is today. And I think you have to have that curiosity in a world that moves as quickly as ours does. But I also am just old enough that I grew up without any of that. And I love things that I can touch and feel. And I think differently when I'm using certain tools. So again, the influence that a tool can have on the person in front of it. Well, that person can be us. That person can be the person that's wielding the tool.
Yeah.
You behave very differently with a pencil in your hand than you do with a pen. And then if you have a stylus, again, even though the motor skills are almost identical, the way that we approach using those tools ends up being different because we know they do different things. We can't hide our knowledge from ourselves.
Yep.
And I remember thinking in the early days of digital, because I say that the SX70 was what led me to photography, and it was, but it wasn't the first camera that I'd had. I mean, I'd had, when I was in my teens, I probably borrowed my mom's camera and I'd had disposables and, you know, all film, obviously. And my parents had a Polaroid and I know I used that, but it was never for anything creative at all. And I can't tell you why. It just felt like, I think my headspace about what cameras were and what photography was hadn't been expanded yet. I didn't understand the world of photography. I was firmly in design and music and aviation and lots of and swimming and just lots of things that weren't photography as art or photography as as even a commercial medium. So cameras were just a thing, a tool to take pictures. That was it. And in my 20s, I had access to, I was running a small creative studio with my brother, and so we could afford to buy cool things for ourselves as business expenses mm-hmm. every once in a while. And so we had a couple of the early Sony CyberShot little point and shoot kind of digital cameras, which I thought were great. You know, they ranged from anywhere from like 1 to 5 megapixels, I think. And I remember having 2 or 3 of those and thinking they were interesting. And I maybe was experimenting a little bit with some of the settings and what you could do with the slightly better optics on those and being able to see the results in real time. But I still didn't consciously think of them as creative tools. And then Polaroid announced they were discontinuing their film. And two friends of mine, Tom Watson and Jason Santa Maria, both friends through the design and tech and web world. I'm very thankful for the two of them for being already interested in Polaroids before I was, because I remember being at South by Southwest in 2006, my first time being there, and Tom must have had his SX70 with him, and I think one other person did.
Right.
And I remember being kind of fascinated by this thing and thinking, oh, that's cool. That would look great on my shelf. What a great design object. I loved product design, and especially back then I was up to my eyeballs in digital product design, but getting burned out on it after too many years. I wanted things I could touch, which is one of the reasons that a few years later I ended up at Moo. I wanted to find where the hybrid was. Mm-hmm. You know, all digital all the time was not good enough. And print felt like a step back if it was on its own. And so I was looking for where the overlap was. And with photography, it ended up being the same kind of thing. Jason Santa Maria, I think, had written, it's probably still somewhere on his archive, so anyone listening, go look it up. It was a wonderful little art-directed ode to a camera that he'd written when Polaroid announced they were discontinuing the film. And so, I 100% got FOMO in the biggest way. I went, oh, crap, this film is not going to be around anymore. I want to be able to tell my grandkids that I shot some of it myself. And that was as far as it went. I went on eBay, found one owner still in the box SX70 for probably $50, which back then now that would be cheap. Back then that would have probably been okay for something in fairly mint, unused condition, but no one wanted them back then either. No. So I bought 2 packs of film and 100% thought that was going to be it. And it wasn't, because it completely transformed the way. So this is probably 2007-ish. Between that 2006, 2007, in that year. And it the first couple of images that came out of that camera changed the way that I thought about what photography was to me and what my relationship was with it. And I love that as a design story, because that was essentially what Edwin Land wanted it to do. And I didn't know that when it happened to me. I only found that out when I did a deep dive in researching how this camera existed and how the film existed. And then I went, oh, okay, great. He wanted it to do this. It did it to me. I've completed the loop there. Yeah. I've read the story and now I've experienced it. And it sent me down this path where, I mean, I bought as much film as I could find while it was still available, and I would travel everywhere with it and shoot with it. Wasn't really using those little cyber shots anymore because they weren't as interesting. And also, they felt like they would be around. So there was something about the urgency as well of, this is a thing that is fleeting that I won't be able to do for very much longer, so I have to do it now. And because of that, I ended up throwing myself at the camera and the format and figuring out how to get decent work out of it. And for someone who had never even thought of that with a camera before, obviously I'd been a designer and creative director at that point for over a decade. And I was a painter before that. So I understood color and form and line and depth and staging. And I understood all those things. I'd never even thought of applying them to photography. And then this camera completely rewired my brain. So that was a wonderful initial experience, which then led me to buying I think it was a Canon XTI, one of the Rebel, the crop APS-C sensors. to try and see, okay, well, is it just that these little point and shoot cameras aren't giving me what I want? You know, maybe I need like an actual lens and some more controls. And then I very quickly after that got a Canon FTB 35 millimeter film camera with a 28-28 lens on it. I still have that camera. It is brilliant because, again, it further changed my understanding, because I was getting better results that on that little Rebel Canon digital than I'd gotten on anything else, but I wasn't in love with them in the same way as I was with the SX70 results. Right. And then I started shooting some film on 35 millimeter, similar format camera, and I loved the results so much more. And there was a tangibility to them as well. So the whole process, I was aware of how different it was. I would drop film off at a lab locally. They would give me prints and a CD-ROM.
Yep.
For people who are listening and don't know what a CD-ROM is, just Google it. Wikipedia parents. Will have a really good thing. Yeah, exactly. Even that interaction, I could still have the digital files, but the first thing that I looked at were these prints. And I loved them. I absolutely, there was a strong emotional connection there. And that's never gone away. I'm explaining all that because that foundation, that's what brought me into the world of photography. And I went away from film as a focus for a good number of years after that, because I just thought, well, I want to do more of this. I want to get a better camera and start understanding lenses and aperture and ISO and optics and the relationship between all of the possibilities that existed in the camera relative to light. So I got a 5D Mark II, which my brother got one as well. That was, again, another brilliant excuse to make a business expense.
Yep.
And started shooting in 2009, I guess. I was now shooting mostly on that. And that coincides with when I started spending time in the UK, which is 2010. Hmm. So I was traveling more. My camera was basically something that I used when traveling, which was mostly for conferences. I was on the conference circuit from that South by Southwest in 2006. And the camera allowed me to see the places where I was ending up. And I would try to book an extra day in places just to experience, because I hadn't traveled that much aside from around the US and a bit of Canada at that point. I grew up in Miami, and the US is massive.
Yeah.
I would leave when I was even younger, I would go visit family. My mom's from the UK. And we'd visit, up until I was about 12, we'd visit my grandparents and cousins and aunts and uncles by flying over the ocean. But it wasn't traveling in that same way. It was just a long journey to get to see relatives. So I was kind of growing and expanding my understanding of the world, of my relationship to it. And the camera was not really a crutch, but it was a tool that I could use to process the information I was seeing and essentially to help me deal with the fact that I was quite overwhelmed by suddenly finding myself in these different places, different countries, mixing with a lot of incredibly intelligent people, which wasn't something I had a lot of access to in Miami. No shade on Miami. It just, at that time, that wasn't the hub for any tech and design stuff. I tried. There just weren't a lot of people there. There were a few, and a couple of them I'm still friends with, 18 plus years on. But it was really overwhelming. I was kind of going from essentially being a small town. People won't think of Fort Lauderdale, as a small town, but for Florida and the US, it is. It's not that big a place. And suddenly I had all of these opportunities in front of me. So the camera kind of allowed me to, some people journal. I ended up taking pictures of the places I was and trying to rationalize it all there. But I remember at the same time feeling frustrated that I had to spend time on the results. So we're talking 2009, 10, 11, 12, in that span. And at that point, I was starting to spend maybe half of my time in the UK. Late 2011 was when I started at Moo. And I was living between the US. Like, I'd spend 1 week a month during the year I was at Moo, 1 week a month in London. And then I was in Newcastle, where my then girlfriend was living. So I was kind of having this northern UK experience while having this town I grew up in experience by the beach, and then London, big city. And also speaking at conferences and teaching workshops all around the world. And I'd had a couple of books that I co-authored that came out 2006, 2007 as well. So, like, I was riding the wave of all of this stuff where So if you imagine, like, in that 5-year span, my entire life had changed. My every context had changed. The way I saw the world changed, and I was continuing to get burned out on digital as well. Mm. You know, speaking for years at these events where you're speaking alongside other, you know, luminaries and published authors and you know, and experts in the collective web and design industries, who were all telling people how things should be done. We were all very altruistic. Here are the best practices. Look at all the things we could do right if we only do them. And 2008, 9, 10, I started like feeling like the audience was pushing back on that. The conversations you'd have afterwards were no longer about how we could make the world better through all of this and increase people's access to all the information. Those conversations were now becoming about how do you think I can make more money or advance my career by doing the things that you've talked about? And it was a bummer. It still is a bummer whenever I think about it. And so you combine that with spending time overseas for me, like completely different country, living part-time in a different country on a different continent. And the camera was the through line, right? Like it was the thing that leveled that experience for me, where it was incredibly chaotic around all of that. Mm. And then I, 2013, I decided to move full-time to the UK. At that same time, I was feeling so burned out on the design and web and tech industry and where it was going that I just needed to step away from it a little bit. And at the time, a little bit was almost entirely. I think I did one major project in 2013. And it was a good project for a friend's agency, and it was something under ESPN. It was a really good, difficult project in the end. But not because of the people working on it. And I just kind of, I got to the end of that and I went, yeah, I need to be doing something else. And when I'd moved, I'd reached out to all of the contacts I'd made in London, all the agencies, all the PR companies and anyone. I just said, hey, I'm here. I have a camera with me and I'd love to be doing photography for you if there are opportunities. And I'm saying all of this because the question was about film. All of that span was digital, basically. 2009 into, you know, we're still in 2013. I'm just thinking, I've got some film cameras, but I didn't really use them. I used them for me. My whole idea was, I will move into something more professional. And to do that, I have to use what the professionals use, which is digital stuff. Alongside all of that, Instagram had become a thing. And I love that I've just told this. This might be the first time I've told that particular arc of the story without mentioning Instagram until after the fact. Because in 2010, in August-ish 2010, I was invited to be a beta tester on Instagram. And I think there were 30 or 40 people beta testing it at the time. It was really, really, no one knew it existed, right? It was a private beta. And I was exploring what these things could do. So that's iPhone 4, the 4S, I think was about to be released then. And it was just coming into its own because I was also, my design brain had been down every rabbit hole about optics and about cameras in general. And I was really kind of fully embedded in how do these things work and how can I squeeze the most out of them, whatever they are. And so I was throwing myself at what the iPhone could do. And you combine that with being invited onto the beta, and then October it launched, and I was in Amsterdam speaking at a conference the week it launched, and so my pictures were kind of a rainy Amsterdam, and they ended up on the iTunes banner, on the iTunes store. Instagram was kind of promoting them, and even then I had this massive 3-year head start basically because of Instagram. That by that time, 2013, that summer was when brands and agencies were really starting to take the platform seriously as something that they should be working with. And so that enabled me, that was the skeleton key that allowed me to reach out to people. I said, look, I'm in London now. I have cameras with me. And also, like, I'd love to do things with your agencies and your clients on Instagram. Let's do this. I could see that's the direction that it was going. And projects happened. But all of this has nothing to do with film either. So God bless you and everyone else for listening. I think it's important to set the context. I always feel, for me, we all have all the details in our head. And no matter how many times I've tried to to make this story I just told succinct. I can't, because they all, every little detail connects and is important. And I think it is for everyone. You know, there's no unimportant little detail that we pass along the road that doesn't affect us in some way. And for me, what happened was, I think I went from the burnout of digital to then throwing myself into photography, but it was all digital. It was either shooting on the phone or shooting on the big digital camera, usually both side by side, because I wanted to make things more difficult for myself. And I found I was working with a lot of brands at the end of 2013, doing a lot of travel and tourism work, which was kind of the first thing that people really took advantage of on the platform. And into 2014, I started teaching workshops. I had a series at Apple, an interview series, where I would invite other people who were making a name for themselves by shooting on iPhones. And we did it at the Regent Street store. It's still, people can still find the video podcast on Apple's channels somewhere, which is amazing. And 2014, like, this kind of thing blew up. I was doing a lot of work, and I was spending so much time on post-production. And the post-production was not fun for me, because what I felt like I was doing was, what I really loved was having the camera, looking for light, looking for compositions, and finding the scavenger hunt. That's how I frame it in my head, and it still is. That is the most fun part. Everything up to when you click the shutter is my favorite part of photography. Everything after that is stuff that you have to do, but I don't love. That's all the accounting. And it's the spreadsheet work of photography. And I know some people love spreadsheets, but that's how it is for me. That's the stuff that I don't enjoy. So making your selects, looking through all the images, looking through all the bad images, right. I basically found I was getting really down on myself every time I was done with the shoot part of a shoot or a project. And then I had to actually spend the hard time and do the hard work of looking through the images, picking my favorites, making the edits, making them look like what I wanted to. It was a big struggle, and I was trying to figure out all the different ways that I could do that, like what that workflow looked like, all the different apps that were available for working with raw images and doing, you know, the early versions of building your own presets. And it was just tedious. It was, none of it was fun, and none of it felt like I was finding my look, or I was iterating like crazy and not liking anything I was landing on. And part of me knew that this was happening over a period of years. So you think 2013, 14, 15 for sure. That was my process. And I was still shooting a little bit of film every once in a while, but it was just for me. And I would take a film camera along on trips. I'd take the Polaroid everywhere.
Yeah.
And I would always look at the output from the film cameras and just think, oh yeah, those are my favorites from this trip. Like, maybe I'd have one really nice shot that, you know, I went to the Faroe Islands for the first time in 2015. I went to Iceland for the first time in 2014. Like, I was going to these amazing places. I didn't take bad photos using the 5D Mark II, right? Like, I was taking good pictures with it. But I loved the pictures that were coming out of the film cameras, because they were just right.
Yeah.
Whatever they looked like, they were right as is. And then I started spending time trying to make my digital images look like the film images. I went down a long rabbit hole for over a year of trying to change the workflow. I even did as much, and I think this thought process had started earlier. I started thinking, how can I change my mindset? I'm also shooting too many images. Like, I don't have any limitations, and I knew the limitations would help me. So I was trying to shoot with smaller CF cards, right? To actually give myself a constraint of, I can't actually just shoot as many pictures as I want. And I was doing all these things, jumping through these hoops to try and make the experience more like what I'd mapped the experience to be on film. And somewhere in that 2015, 2016 range, I'd also started shooting with Sony's, the early A7R and then the R2. And they were really interesting because I could use my film lenses, and I started to slow down a little bit and use manual focus because of the focus peaking, and that was helping. You can tell it was a big workflow exercise of how can I get the same enjoyment that I have when I'm shooting my film cameras using these digital tools, because the digital tools are obviously incredibly capable. And I was getting closer and closer and closer. And sometime during 2016, I decided that I was going to shoot more film on some of these travel projects because I liked the results so much. It occurred to me one day, I just went, you know what? Like if I just shot that entire trip on film, I'd be done. I'd just make my selects, send them to the client, and they'd be perfect. And I would spend no time staring into Aperture or Lightroom. And that appealed to me. So I thought, okay, well, the only way to prove this is to experiment. So I'm just going to do more. I'm going to take what felt like a risk, like you were saying, like that seems risky to people who haven't really embraced film, where you know what you've shot with digital. And honestly, it was like one project I did in 2016 where I shot as much on film as on digital, maybe a bit more. I think I really looked at that project. It was for Bombay Sapphire. It was a nice little project at their distillery outside of London. And I thought, I'm going to shoot film first, not film because I'm there. And digital would be the backup. If there was a picture that either I didn't have the ISO for on my film and I needed it, if there was something low light, digital. If there's a picture that I really, really want that's going to be a hero shot, I'll take a digital backup just in case. And the post-production part of that project completely changed because all the film was great. There was nothing wrong with it. Like I used so few digital images in the final deliverable. And also I realized the client didn't care. Like they were thrilled either way. They just wanted the images. They didn't care how I made them. So that one project completely rewired because I treated it as an experiment. I said, well, like this isn't, I'm not going to fail at this. I'm just going to learn something. And I trust film enough now in the lab that I've been using that I think it's going to be okay. And it was okay. And from that moment on, film was the primary, digital was the backup. And I went a couple of years shooting like that, where I'd take the Sony or the Canon, or usually both, along on projects, straight through at least 2018, maybe even into 2019. I was still taking a film camera with me. 2016, I also got a Leica Q, and I got that. I borrowed that to take with me to Japan to do the walk of the Kumano Kodo with Craig Maud. And that turned into my first book, which he and I co-photographed and co-designed, and which was called Koya Bound. It's still a brilliant object and was a brilliant experience. And I shot that all digital after already being kind of into this mindset of, I think I'm just going to shoot primarily film. So I have a preference, but it's not like a, you know, an either or. It's not an absolute thing in my head. But what I arrived to in that span of 2017, 18, 19 was, I just want to use the right tool for the job. If there's a shoot that I have where I don't know what the lighting is going to be like, or I can't really predict it, or I can't control it, then the digital might end up being the first thing that comes out, or the only thing that comes out. Because I can, especially with the Leica Q, I did a couple of projects on that because it was, you could whack that to 10,000 ISO and get useful images out of it that didn't look like the gain had been pushed up. And it was fun to use because, again, it was a constraint. You know, this 28 mil fixed lens, like, well, I don't have a lot to carry around, but I also don't have a lot of choice. So you got to make do with what you have. And my brain thrives on that. So going back to film, I'm again, still a hybrid photographer. I did, a workshop and a talk at WPPI in 2019 that was all about hybrid shooting for people who did weddings and portrait work, to really just tell them, look, here's the economics of it, here's the stuff that you're worried about, and here's why you don't have to worry about it, and here's why this is actually a really sensible approach to you that will make your work more fun, more enjoyable. Also makes your digital edits so much easier if you're not doing an edit that looks really far away from what film would look like, right? So it's not for everyone. That's one of the things that's great about digital, is that you can make it look like whatever you want. Mm. But to an extent, you can do that with film as well. Like you get, and this is what I started. I found it more interesting, the challenge of, I don't have a lot of options of film stocks. I've got some sort of delay and, you know, baked in where I won't be able to see what I've captured and I need to get it to labs. Although the reality of that is that if you line up your labs properly and you know what your turnaround time needs to be, I have London labs that I can drop film off with them at 9 or 10 a.m. and I have scans by the end of the day. That's faster than I could do the same process digitally. I wouldn't even be able to look through things, let alone get images that were in a pretty final state. And even some of my labs that I work with that I mail film to, same kind of thing. If I tell them ahead of time, hey, I've got this shoot, it's going to arrive to you here. Like, what's your turnaround time? Can we make sure that that's going to work to get it to the client? It works. And clients also understand, because what I found now, and this is interesting, and a change that's happened, definitely happened since the pandemic, is that even though clients still don't really care what you use to create the image, they're more interested when they find out that it's analog.
Right.
And a client's interest in your process is a good thing. Yeah. It also means that they know that they can't necessarily just make any tweaks or changes they want. Right. Not that I deal with that a lot, but it creates a little bit of a distance from the planning mm-hmm. and the conceptualizing and the art direction and the scheduling and everything else and the end result. They're not things that you can have someone looking over your shoulder and going, oh, can we take that again, but from like 3 inches to the left?
Yeah.
And I appreciate that, because again, it's the, how does the tool affect the people who are using it or in front of it mm-hmm. or in the client's case around it or part of that process? And this was, I'd love to go back and check how long this answer was, because it's probably set a record for you. But I think, again, this is stuff that my journey is something that only I've been on. And it's really, really particular, because it involves and starts with me being a designer. And everything that I have done in my photographic career has come through the lens of being a product designer. Like, I want to know how the thing works, and I want to know how it changes me, not just how it changes the output. I'm not just looking at a lens and saying, you know, well, how does this render, and what will this allow me to do, and what are other examples of this, you know, what have other people taken on this lens and body combination? I want to know how it changes my eye. How, mm-hmm. when I am pre-visualizing this particular focal length and this potential for, you know, this aperture on this lens, on this film, how does that change my entire thought process? And I'm really analytical about that until I get to the point where I think I understand it, and then I forget it all, and then I just play and have fun. And that's actually the thing that like drew me to the smartphone in the first place, was that I thought, well, this is different. This is not as complicated as the cameras I've been using. Yeah, it's not as good, but within the parameter, what are the parameters within which I can operate where it doesn't look like it's bad? Like, okay, nothing backlit, nothing too dark, but and you play with, and I've taken that learning came from trying to do what I could with smartphones. And I've now applied that to every camera, digital or film, and every film format, everything. There is a thing that every tool we have is really good at. There's a range within which a tool sings.
Yeah.
And if you find out what that range is for you and for the work you're trying to do with it, then you now know, okay, I know when I need that tool. I know when I need to pull that from the shelf, because I can see what I want to do with it, and I know where that range is of whatever the output or the light or the subject matter or the how much I need to be able to move around, how flexible I need to be, whatever those constraints happen to be. Mm-hmm. I know which equipment I have suits that range. And that, so I'm 100% pro film, but I also still have my digital cameras. I've got too many of them on both sides of the aisle, but especially because the digitals don't get used that much. But I'm even pushing myself I'm getting more and more into motion, mm-hmm. which has been a very delayed process because it was supposed to happen around the pandemic, and then that just pushed everything back. But I'm playing with digital and film for it. And now that I trust the hybrid approach implicitly, it's a whole lot easier to just go, let's play with film on this, and all the edits are going to be digital anyway, but let's get a completely flat log grade on it, and we can make the film look like pretty much whatever we want it to or need it to anyway.
Yeah.
And then I can use my Super 8 and 16 mil experiments to feed into how I film in 4K or 6K or 8K on digital, and what my post-production and grading is. And for me, that mixture of everything just being kind of knotted up in a ball of twine creatively, that's more fun. That's more interesting. It's less straightforward, but that works better for me.
I think you'll get a more interesting product at the end of it though as well, because you're allowing yourself a bunch of different ingredients there. You know, it's like when they made Dune and they shot on digital, put onto film, and then, you know, like that – that way of shooting the thing digitally for convenience and because it gave them the sharpness that they wanted, but then dialing that back, and you're using film, the transfer to film process, and then the scanning of that back to digital as a part of the recipe. It's like frying something and then removing it from the pan and then frying something else. You know, you're not just, it's not just all thrown in together. There's this idea that like you've got to do either one or the other, and like no, these are all brushes. And it's what is so good about an extended, at various points of that conversation when I'm smiling like an idiot, it's because I'm delighted that you're kind of confirming a bunch of biases for me in terms of creative people approach tools in a way it doesn't. I'm increasingly of the mindset from these conversations, and it's why I think I'm going to turn the themes from them into something written, is because I think there are, if you're good, if you apply yourself to a certain creative area, you can move then more easily between them later on. And I think that sometimes comes as a surprise to people when they can. But as you said, you understood light, you understood color, you understood line, you know, you can see that thing in your head of like, this is a moment in a frame. This is how I can frame something. And then the Polaroid just got you so excited because the SX70, you're absolutely right. What a wonderful, incredible device. I have an SLR 680 on the shelf.
Oh yeah, brilliant.
Same thing, right? Just a bit of autofocus thrown in for good measure. Tremendous, tremendous camera. Like, absolutely love opening and closing that thing. Like, one day it will break and it will break my heart. But it's just, what an incredible object to exist. And actually, on the subject of flaky cameras, and you're being very generous with your time, so I don't want to go too long, but the Widelux, is that still in your bag? Because I have a project in mind for a Widelux, and it's about the idea in my head is like a week old, but I need to get hold of one, and then I need someone to say yes to the project. But are you enjoying, because you went to the America to see the Jeff Bridges exhibition, didn't you?
Yeah, so I mean, it's safe for me to talk about it a bit more openly now, but I, for just over a year now, I've been an advisor on the project to bring back the new Widelux. And the meetup, this will be too late for anyone listening to this podcast because I think it'll already have happened, but the meetup I mentioned that's going to be on the Saturday night of Photo London is kind of for panoramic enthusiasts. I mean, that's going to be what it's going to be wrapped in, but we're going to have one of the partners, one of the partners of the Widelux project, Karis, who's also the editor of Silver Grain Classics magazine.
Yes.
She's going to be flying over from Germany, and we're just going to have kind of an informal thing, but a chance to just connect a little bit more with people who like shooting panoramic images. That could be on film or digital. It doesn't matter. We're seeing like great things with cameras like the Hasselblads and the Fujis being able to do an X-Pan crop, and I love it. I mean, I'm an X-Pan fan. I have two of them, and I use them for a lot of what I would categorize as my future fine art work.
Right.
I love the panoramic ratio. And the Widelux, I've had mine's an F8, and I've had it for a year and a half now, I think. So I got it when I knew the project. They'd announced the Widelux project in 2023, and I kind of went, I need to get my hands on one because this is going to be a thing. Didn't have any idea that I'd be involved with it, but I love panoramic photography. It's a unique beast, and this is one of the other things. There is not a single digital camera that can do what that does because it has a curved film plane and a panning lens, and you could make a swing lens on a non-curved digital sensor, but it would just look weird.
Yep.
I'm sure someone out there could make a curved digital sensor, but I can't imagine what the expense of that would be. Also,
why? For that one application.
Good for one thing.
Yeah.
Yep. And so again, this is one of the wonderful things about film, is that these cameras exist that do a thing that is completely unique. It gives you it's a new brush. It's like if you had been painting oils your entire life and never knew that a palette knife existed.
Yeah.
And then someone goes, hey, here's this thing that you can use with the exact same paints and canvases that you've already been using, but it gives you a look that and a texture that you can't get with any of the brushes. Yeah. The brushes will not do this. And it would blow your mind, and rightly so. And obviously, that's how I view, and I think how we should all view, all of these tools. It's why I loved getting all of the lens adapters for the Sony A7 series. I mean, I still do. I have my A7 R2. I don't use it a ton. I use it more for camera scanning now, for scanning using my, like, I've got a couple of different pieces of hardware from a company called Veloy that allow you to scan 35 millimeter and medium format film really easily. And that camera is a really good base for a scanner. But it's also something I've been using for filming bits of motion for years now. And thinking that that's nearly a 10-year-old camera, you can whack any lens on it, film in 4K, S-Log, and it looks great.
Yep.
And it doesn't need all the other bells and whistles because really you just need it to do that. And the lenses, that's actually what taught me using the Sonys. So again, something I love about digital, using all of my, and I really do mean almost all of my film lenses on the Sony bodies, made me realize how much of the image is influenced by the lens and its coatings, because the sensor wasn't changing. And suddenly I realized, oh, everything else is changing, even like the warmth of certain lenses versus how cool Zeiss lenses are. You know, they're definitely colder. And people talk about that a little bit, but unless you see that stuff for yourself, you can't really wrap your head around it. And again, for me, it's all about understanding what's the range that where I can use this tool. And so I think about that now for film as well. So the Widelux, though, is I still use it. It is quirky, but I'm finding more ways to use it. I bring it along on certain shoots so I can snap, you know, even a couple of frames on it. Basically the same thing I started doing when I was bringing a film camera along on my digital shoots. I do that now with something like the Widelux to say, I don't know how this fits in. I don't know exactly what I can do with it, but I've seen other people do some cool things with it, and it's given me new ideas. And I know there are a couple of things I've been trying lately that I won't say here because I want to explore them more myself, but also because I don't see any other evidence that anyone has been doing them, and that's great. Like, I've taken this thing, this old thing, and I'm merging it with some newer tools, and I've made a new thing that I might be the first person on the planet that's done this, and maybe I haven't, but I don't care. It's fun, right? And that's the, you know, that kind of sums up the way I approach everything. So yeah, if you can get your hands on a Widelux, I think, you know, you should. It's a if you're the kind of person who's curious about tools that give you a different way of seeing. I mean, that thing, you cannot really pre-visualize what it's going to do. You can start to get a little bit of an understanding, but it is its own beast. It's going to do its own thing, and you can kind of go, well, I think the distortion is going to do this when I angle it like this, or if I move the camera while I'm exposing it, but you don't really know. And the more you try it, the more predictable those results become. Just like with Jeff's a comedy tragedy series, of which are amazing,
great photos.
Right? But I haven't talked with him about that, but I'm sure he's probably explained this in an interview somewhere that someone could go find. But you can kind of guarantee that his first experiments with that didn't go according to plan, right? Like, he had to figure out what the right exposure length was, and how to move, how quickly to move, when to move, where to position people, all of that stuff. And then you get the rolls back later, and see, and you see whether you got it right or not, and you try to remember the
how
process.
You did it.
I think that's another thing that I talked about this in my session for the journalists last week. That it's not about bringing analog tools back into a digital workflow, because that's impractical for a lot of reasons, especially on a journalistic timeline. But the thought process is valuable, because there's not a lot of pre-visualization that goes on with digital anymore, because you can see the results as soon as you click the shutter. You can preview, you can do a lot of previs for motion, but if you're doing fast run and gun motion, you don't. You show up to the place and you have your monitor, and you're looking at what's on the monitor, and that's telling you what's in your frame. And if you were doing that on film, you'd have to trust yourself. You'd have to say, I know I'm getting that. I know what the settings are. And because you would trust yourself, you'd go, yeah, I got it. Let's move on to the next thing with certainty, right? It doesn't mean that you will get it 100% of the time, but the more you practice that kind of approach of trusting yourself, the better you get at avoiding the trap of, oh, we'll just take that again, but from a different angle, or while I've still got the light, let me get that three different ways. Sometimes you do that on film, but like I'm just finishing up the post on a project for a client that's a mixture of a mixture of styles, but includes some product photography. And the product photography needed to be, I don't do product photography, but this was environmental product work. And that was interesting. And it was also my own kind of concept of how to approach it, but I was doing it all on film.
Yeah.
And I had very little of the light I wanted to work with because I was out in the world, couldn't create the light. And there were times where I took 3, 4, 5 of the same setup because I was like, this light might go away in 10 minutes. I'm just going to get this and I have to get, I know I've got the one I need. I'm going to give myself a few other options. So you still shoot like that sometimes, but I knew what I had.
Yeah.
And without seeing it. And I have never experienced that when shooting digital. I've never gone, click, I don't need to look at the preview. Your brain doesn't do that because you know you can, and you go, yeah, I just want the confirmation. I want to feel good about myself, like I did get it. And honestly, for any, I'm curious about this for anyone listening too. Not that it never happens, but how frequently do you take the first picture on any digital camera and go, yeah, I nailed that.
Yeah.
Versus taking one or another one just in case, or no, it wasn't quite right. And I know for sure that all of my friends who shoot film commercially, professionally, not just as a hobby, right? When it matters, I think that's a very different headspace.
Yeah.
They all feel the same. Their success rate is higher. The number of usable images that come out of a shoot is much higher, like an order of magnitude higher when shooting film. And they rarely shoot a frame twice.
Yeah.
Because they, you know when you've got it. And if you shoot a frame twice, it's because you go, eh, I'll try another aperture, or oh, maybe did she blink? You know, but you know it, and it's a really tough thing to kind of explain that. But it's the certainty of I'm not seeing it, but because of that, I'm more connected with the tools.
Yeah.
And again, whether it's a wide lux or a Polaroid or whatever that tool is, there's a lot that we can learn from that and then port into our digital work. I don't overshoot on my smartphone anymore.
Right.
And I haven't for years and years and years. I just shoot the same way, as I don't hit the shutter until I know that I've got what I want. And that's exactly how I work with film.
Yeah.
And I think that's the best lesson that I've taught myself and internalized from allowing myself the freedom to kind of explore film, which, let's be honest, is the most mature of all the mediums for image making. It's been around so long. It is so... And you talk about, I'm conscious of your time as well here, because we could definitely make this a 3-hour plus podcast. But you mentioned something that I want people thinking about, how to mix the tools, because if that's like, I'd rather talk about that. I've talked enough about myself and my own little process and story, but the takeaways for people, for me, are always, how can I change the way someone thinks in even a small way when I'm on stage, when I'm on a podcast or something else, that will enable them to try some things they wouldn't have tried otherwise if they hadn't have heard this or read something I wrote. And so you mentioned with Dune, outputting the digital to film and then scanning that back in. I mean, that's happening a lot. The last scene, I don't know if you're a Severance fan, but anyone who is a Severance fan, the last scene of season 2 was output to film to get a different feel, and it looks great. Yep. They also used some 16 mil during season 2, which was also great because it was easier to just film 16 mil to get that look than it was to film digital and then process it. Oh. But A Complete Unknown, the film about
Bob Dylan,
all filmed digital because they wanted to film in really natural, kind of as much as possible, natural low light situations. They wanted to feel really gritty. So they filmed digitally, big sensor, high ISO, and they output the entire film to film so that they could then kind of anchor all of those pixels in something that was more real and more appropriate to the era of the story that was being told. And it feels good because of that. It's not a tangible thing that most people who watch that film won't know it and won't care, but that's not the point, right? We have to keep as much enjoyment and curiosity in our process. Otherwise, we just let the tools drive what we do. And thinking about ways that you can take This is one thing I will say, because I'd be happy for someone else to do this before I do, because I don't know when I'll get around to it. I'm just curious. I'm going to make a film, a short little documentary film on the iPhone. And once it's edited, I'm going to, before it's gone through the grading process, I'm going to get it output to 16 mil. Because why not? And what the heck's it going to look like? And also, that's not going to be a lot of film. It won't. It'll be like the least expensive digital to film transfer that I could do. But I'm really curious about how, as far as these have come, they're still limited by physics. Small sensor, small lenses, trying to do a lot in post-production. And, you know, Soderbergh has made a couple of films on iPhones, and they're brilliant, but they still slightly feel like they were filmed on an iPhone with a lot of really good lighting. And there's a rumor that the 28 years later film has been at least mostly or partially filmed on an iPhone,
right?
But with loads of lenses strapped to them and other things.
Right.
There's a look that often I think people are going for with that. I'm really curious, like, what if we merge these mediums? Can you take a film that was shot on something that was shot on an iPhone and make it feel like it wasn't? Can you fool the viewer so that they're not thinking of it as a low quality kind of thing?
Yeah.
Which, for the most part, now they won't anyway, if you frame correctly and you light correctly. Yeah. But all of, that's a little experiment. It's not going to be very complicated. It'll be harder for me to make the film in the first place than it will be to go, oh, and now I've got the edit. Let's bounce it out here. Same with all like audio production. My my recording engineer 20 years ago, probably. Yeah, 20 years ago this year, had a fully digital recording studio in Nashville. But part of his mastering process was pushing everything through analog tubes.
Right.
So you'd get the mix, and then you'd put it out through and pipe it through an analog system and then back into the digital to get the warmth.
Yep. Yep.
And like, this is not, it's not rocket science. It's just using the tools that are available to us. Use your pens, use your pencils, use paper. I use typewriters on a daily basis. Mm. Totally not a topic we're going to go into today, but it's because they're fun and they're a little anachronistic, but also they feel super modern when we use them. The Widelux does not feel like an old camera. It feels like some weird scientist experiment thing, but if you told someone it was a new thing,
they'd go, sure.
In this age of weird Kickstarter campaigns for everything, like, of course, someone just tried a thing that they didn't know whether it would work or not. We just have to embrace everything that's around us, because I think that's ultimately what allows us to stay connected to what we're making, and it keeps things more fun.
Yeah, I do say everything's connected to teams that I work with a lot of the time, and I think this conversation and others that I've had absolutely confirmed to me that there's no such thing as like traditional disciplines where something is creative or something is not creative. I think there's an element of the person in everything that we do, and all of these things are ingredients or tools to be applied to the problem of making the thing that you want to make, right? And I think that's where, like, shooting with a certain type of camera, I shoot with like an M. I really love the way it renders an image and the way the image looks, and that's glass as well, right? But the experience of holding that thing, looking through a piece of glass and looking at the world and then pushing the button. And, you know, you were saying about the Zeiss lenses made me chuckle, because regular listeners will know that my favorite lens ever is my Zeiss 35-28, because that's what a photo looks like to me. And it's just, it's Ali, who was previously on the show, coined the phrase Zeissy. It's got a very Zeissy look, and it's amazing. You know, it sings in black and white in a way. I'll send you afterwards a photo I took of my son, my youngest, with a leaf and stuff in black and white. That's just, that lens captured that moment in a way that I don't think any other lens I own or have ever seen quite would. It's a combination of sharp and textured, but kind of antique and stuff in around the edges in a way that is just, oh, it's delicious. I could look at that picture all day. It's, you know, it's on my screens quite a lot because it's in the background, you know.
And that right there is the biggest takeaway, is that we just have to love what we're making. Mm. If what you're trying to do is mimic what someone else is making, cool, great. There's a lot of stuff you can learn in that. And if you love it, fantastic. But I really dislike seeing people judge other people's creative choices as being somewhat, you know, on some technical level, better or worse. Right, and we see that too much in digital for sure. But I've read articles from the film era where people were still having that same argument with resolution. Yeah. So it's just a human thing. But you know, look at film like Poor Things, and the lots of Petzval lens use and other weird lenses that make that contribute to how you feel when you're watching it and how you feel what the characters are feeling. And it's just, and sometimes maybe it's just because it was weird, not because it was trying to do anything deeper than that.
Yeah.
And it looks amazing and it's fantastic and it's still wrapped in a good story. So who the hell cares? Like, why would you need to just, it's this, there are people who say, oh, I'll never use anamorphic lenses. Okay, great. But that don't say bad things about someone who chooses to use them or loves them. We've all got to love what we do in order to make the best thing. If we don't, then we're just doing left foot, right foot, and we're marching in time. And for the creative industries, I'm not saying art is its own thing and doesn't have to have any justification for existing, but for creative industries where we're also making things for people or to sell to people, or there's a little bit more of the product cycle in there, we still have to love it. If we don't love it, why the heck should anyone else love it? And loving it means not just the end result. It means making it. It means the process. It means everything that we touch there. And there is always a version of some part of our process that if we don't like it, we can find a way to turn it into a version that we like, even if that means hiring someone else to do it in Tim Ferriss style.
No, exactly. That is actually probably a lovely note to bring us to a close on. You've got to like the things that you make. For people who want to see a bit more Dan and a bit more of the stuff that you make, where can they find a little bit more Dan?
My brain is horrible because I want to say, my OnlyFans is but that is not a thing. Should be. That's an experiment I haven't tried yet.
I will ruin the joke for people, but if you go to Casey Neistat's website, there is it's very plain and there are just links, and there is a link to OnlyFans. And when you click on it, it takes you to a page that says, oh God, no, but could you imagine? And I love how he had this moment when he was making his webpage. He's like, I'm going to make people think for a minute that I've got an OnlyFans. And he's like, no, I don't, obviously.
Fantastic. Well, the best, put that in quotes, the easiest place to find work that I am doing and have done is still Instagram. As much as I have a fraught relationship with that platform, that's where things are, and there's a lot there, and it's easy for people to get to. And so I'm just at Dan Rubin on Instagram, and love it or hate it, it's there, it works, it's easy for people to find. I have a whole lot of stuff I'm working on behind the scenes to get more things on a website. It's funny, someone who spent nearly 20 years building websites really still struggles with the idea of spending more time building websites, even if it's for me. But there's stuff in progress, and so there's a handful of stuff on my website, which is very, very, very minimal.
Yes,
can't even speak about it. But that is danrubin.is, and if you like the idea of reading things in print, I write the occasional article on Silvergrain Classics, a wonderful magazine all about analog, and they publish some things on their website, but I really kind of love that they don't publish everything. You have to kind of buy the magazine to find some of those articles. And there will be other places that those things end up. But yeah, those are the starting points. And now I feel like there has to be, before we wrap up, a discussion of three lenses.
Sure. Well, I mean, we've covered a few, but yes, by all means, if you've got some lenses, we love to chuck in some lenses, especially towards the end as a little thing. Yeah, what were you thinking? Because I assumed maybe your SX70, you were like expertly weaving these in as you were going. But yeah.
Well, I did give some thought to this prior to this conversation. Mm. So one of them, I love the Pentax 6.7. It's my main workhorse for commercial work when it's the right camera. But there's a lens on it that most people don't know about, and I adore it because it's fantastic for traveling when you don't want to have a bunch of lenses with you and swapping through lenses. I'm not a zoom lens fan, but this lens is one of my favorite lenses. It's the 55-100. And if you're a Pentax 6.7 user out there listening to this, look that lens up. It's a sleeper. It's a 4.5 aperture straight through, which is fine for the kind of work you would use that for. but it is just an incredible lens. It's not super heavy. I've used it for all sorts of really long day hikes where I don't want to risk getting dust in the lens. I don't want to drop anything. I just go, yeah, this lens gives me a focal length range that I can work with. It's just stellar. Makes me very happy. I love my original 80-28 Hasselblad Zeiss lens. It's you mentioned your 35 Zeiss, like looking like what a photo should look like. Yeah. That the Zeiss planar or planar, I'll have to ask someone from Zeiss sometime how to pronounce that properly. That look is, if it's on a Rolleiflex, if it's on a Hasselblad, if it's on, it doesn't matter where that is, that planar look at that focal length is just great. And you can shoot with those lenses wide open and they just separate everything. They make everything look better than it does in reality.
Yep.
And I should use that, my Hasselblad, more, but you know, I'm spoiled for choice. The third and final one though for you is another medium format 6-7 lens. And it's possibly my favorite camera and lens combination. And it's the Pablo Makina 6-7, which is a folding rangefinder. It's basically an M6. It's got a tiny light meter in it. It's a Leica M6, but in medium format, 6-7. And it's just magical. Nikon made the lens, and it's an 80-28 again, but it renders like nothing else. It's really tough to explain my relationship with the images that come out of that camera. Back when I had access to Fuji 400H, the combination of 400H film and the Makina was unbeatable. Still will forever, I think, be unbeatable. But those are my three, and they're not standard. That zoom lens, though, don't sleep on it, Pentax lovers.
No, well, we won't. I will almost certainly get messages from Pentax folks off the back of this for sure.
Well, no, cool. Ian, it's been a brilliant chat. I've enjoyed it.
Me too.
I hope this doesn't cause a nightmare for you editing-wise with my lack of... I'm like a trumpet player. I can speak while circular breathing. But it's been a joy for me.
Yes. No, I've loved it. And I've been grinning through this because it's always nice when, as we said right back at the beginning, when there's a bit of a build-up and there's a bit of like back and forth and planning and it takes a while, but then when you get to sit down with someone and there's lots of like nice unexpected like twists and turns, and I like to say that these conversations tell me what they're about at a certain point. There comes a point where they like it makes sense and you go, oh, I know what this one is. So no, I've loved this one. It's been exactly what I hoped it would be. And we should have you back on to talk wide things at some point.
Oh, I'd love that.
Yeah, cool. All right, thanks a lot, Dan. Take it easy.
Cheers, Ian. You too.
Bye. Once again, a massive thank you to Dan for being on the show. That was a long time coming, that conversation. We'd been trying to organise it for ages, but they're always worth waiting for. That's what I've found. The longer it takes to organise, the better the chat is when you get around to it. If you enjoyed that, you can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. So if that's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube Music, Pocket Casts, Amazon Music, all those places, just subscribe to the show. And if you like it, tell a friend. Pass it on to someone. That would be a really great way to help us continue to grow and find an audience. There is also the weekly newsletter that goes out every week on a Wednesday, and you can subscribe to that at ianfarrell.com/sign-up. Right. Well, I'm going to go and sort through some Polaroids from the weekend. Have an amazing rest of the week, and we'll see you next time.